University, who's been at Warwick, I think, since 1999. Before that was a professor at Durham. I'm sure most, if not all of you, will know of Steve's work. He's a prolific author and I think has published 13 books, or is it 15 books, and I'm sure several more in the pipeline, and hundreds of articles. And the later, I don't think this probably is the latest, but the latest one that I've seen is this Science
Versus. No wonder you thought it was 13, okay.
Which is a very interesting book about intelligent design and the problem of evolution. Steve is not afraid to court controversy, as you'll be aware from tackling this kind of topic. And today he is going to talk to the title of Does Science Communication Really Need to Distinguish Fact and Fiction? So with that said, over to you, Steve.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to try to speak for 40 minutes to open the floor to questions. The first thing I want to say is that I am glad that I am also the other keynoter, Patricia Farah. Are you here? Or there you are. Okay. This book that she's recently written, which I think is an excellent book, 4,000 Years of the History of Science, and I hope it comes out in paperback very soon, because I don't know how many of you teach general history of science, where in a sense you want kind of a, you know, sort of one-stop shopping approach, you know, where you get one book that in a way can cover it all for you, and cover it in a sort of progressive, up-to-date kind of way. I mean, it seems to me, I don't know, some of you look a bit older, that you may know there is this book by Stephen Mason about the history of science that originally came out maybe, what, 40, 50 years ago in the first edition. And this is a natural successor to that in terms of getting a very kind of progressive sort of view of the entire history of science, reflecting all of the latest thinking with regard, especially to things concerning social constructivism and so forth, but without foregrounding it. So in other words, the theory is not foregrounded. It's implicit in the ways in which the selections and the ways in which people are being talked about and so forth. And in a way, it's very much a kind of model of how you bring history of science into science communication. Okay, so I really recommend this book very strongly, and I hope it gets into paperback very soon. No, because I do think, because, you know, I mean, there is a sense of what exemplars are, especially with regard to the interface between science communication and history of science, and since you happen to be here, I might as well mention that, because I think that's, there is no book, it's been a long time in the making to get a book of this kind. And in a way, this is not the talk I want to give, but I do think one of the problems with the way in which our disciplines with regard to history, philosophy, sociology, and the other science studies fields are organized, is there's not much of an incentive within the academic structure to actually have people write these kinds of general histories. So that when one wants to turn to a sort of general history of science, one is forced to go back to what, Dampier, or, you know, whatever, God knows, right? I mean, these things that are like 50, 60, 70, 80, 90 years old at this point. And so it's very good that we actually have one book that in fact is a you know, admirable successor to that, reflecting the latest scholarship. So I recommend this book very highly. Okay, so is that one point. And I want to thank Mark for inviting me today to talk on this topic. The other thing I want to mention, which I was talking to you about, Mr. Chair, earlier, is that this coming week we're having a Festival of Social Science, again in the spirit of science communication, here at Warwick University, which is a social science-based university. And I'm running a blog there having to do with making the university safe for intellectual life in the 21st century. Okay, and if you can find the blog, I think, pretty easily at this point. It's been advertised in the electronic newsletter of the Times Higher. One of the things that I plan to bring up this week as an entry, and again, I think this is quite relevant to the interests of people here, is I've been recently asked by my vice chancellor to come up with a sort of prospectus for a general education program, which is a very unusual thing in the United Kingdom. Of course, you know, there have been all these programs in the U.S. At Harvard and Chicago and Columbia and places of that kind. But now Warwick is going to attempt to do this, which is to say that in the first year of study, there would be some common courses to all students regardless of what sort of specialization they enter into. you may know that in the United States, you don't enter in with a specialization, right? And so you have a couple of years to actually decide this. But in this country, of course, you enter with a specialization. But the idea being that no particular specialization, whether we're talking about the arts or the sciences, necessarily prepares people for the various changes that are taking place in the world in which they live. So there's a certain renewed value to reintroducing general education, and the question becomes, what should be the content of this? And so I've been asked to come up with a proposal with regard to that. And so I have this blog, and I'm going to actually lay out some initial thoughts on this probably Sunday or Monday. And so, you know, if you want to contribute, you have some ideas on the matter, please feel free to do so. Okay? So those are the advertisements there. Now, what I want to talk about here, and again, this is a kind of open-ended topic, and so I hope there's some serious, you know, we have some time for some serious discussion. And I mean the question seriously. Namely, does science communication really need to distinguish fact and fiction? And this has a lot to do with various ways in which science has set up boundaries with regard to things that are counted as non-science. And I've been sort of in the middle of a lot of those sorts of problems. And I don't know how far back you have any of you have followed my career, but I was actually in the volume of social text that Alan Sokol spoofed. Okay, I mean, those of you with long memories, in 1996, right, this physicist at New York University, Alan Sokol, basically did, I guess what you might call a parody of a state-of-the-art cultural studies article, and published it in the main cultural studies journal in North America, okay, and this was on a special issue, right, having to do with science. And so it included Sandra Harding and Emily Martin, and included Richard Levins, the co-author with Lewontin on various issues, and I was in there as well. And then the point about this article, which was basically to show how, supposedly, all sorts of cutting-edge developments in mathematics and physics in the 20th century, in fact, support all kinds of progressive, postmodernist kind of cultural ideas. And this article was written in a way that, first of all, was incredibly heavily footnoted. It was by far the most heavily footnoted article in the issue. It was making references to all kinds of literary, cultural studies, philosophical stuff, as well as scientific stuff. But it was laced at various points with kind of errors that often were kind of funny if you actually knew what the science was, but if you didn't, you might take it quite seriously, okay? And then once this thing got published, Sokol went directly to the New York Times, and so it was actually a front page article in the New York Times in May 1996, and then everybody was asked to sort of comment, and what does it say, and so forth. The interesting thing about this, from the standpoint, and this was a point I actually raised in a letter that I sent to the Times Literary Supplement, which continues to discuss this matter, actually, was that it's unfortunate that people who consider themselves social constructivists with regard to science, and in that sense, you know, take seriously the idea that the context is a big part of what determines the content of what's being said, right, as it were, who's in the room at the time when the content gets decided, right? That's, in a sense, kind of what social constructivism says. Nevertheless, will so easily grant authority to Sokol when he comes out and he says, hey, look, this is a spoof. You know, I wrote this article to trick these guys, and I tricked them because they published it. Okay, so in other words, you know, you think about this, if you, those of you who know anything about literary theory and hermeneutics and all this, When you accept that kind of view, you're granting authorial intention as having authority over what the content of the text is. And that's supposed to be the sort of thing that social constructivism was against. But nevertheless, when it came to the crunch, right, everybody rolled over. Right, and then people made up excuses, basically, right, saying, "Well, you know, he was being dishonest." Right, all this kind of moralism started coming into play. I mean, Stanley Fish and others started writing articles in the New York Times. Those of you again who remember this, right, that there was no there was no problematization of any fact and fiction thing going on here. It was rather kind of a morality issue suddenly came into play. They tricked us. Right? They didn't make their intentions clear. But come on, you guys, you believe intentions are constructed. Right? And this was kind of my view in the whole thing. And I was amazed that, in fact, this was kind of how the discussion took place. And so, you know, there are a lot of different issues here at play. And one of them, first of all, is the extent to which those of us who believe, and I consider myself in this category, I do consider myself a social constructivist, right? The issue is, are you just a sort of social constructivist in the seminar room, right? And then when you're out in the real world, right, all of a sudden we have a real world, right? That all of a sudden, you know, because it seems to me that's kind of the way in which people have responded to this social text episode. And moreover, this has had all kinds of reverberations with regard to the development of science and technology studies over the past dozen or more years, right, since this has taken place. So, for example, I mean, those of you who follow the career of Harry Collins, for example, right, Harry Collins now believes that the goal of science studies is to reproduce by sociological means the expertise the scientists have, or get as close to it as possible. Right, so in a sense, you can pass a Turing test with regard to being a scientist. Scientists can't tell the difference between you and a real scientist. And my God, the way you did it wasn't by getting a PhD in physics, but was by hanging around physicists long enough. And so you end up producing an 800-page book on gravitational waves. Now, you know, my question is, okay, is this a big deal? Right? And then Bruno Latour, on the other hand, who's gone on to bigger and greater things, nevertheless regrets the fact that you have people who are against global warming and creationists and all these disreputable people suddenly picking up on this social constructivist stuff and trying to run with it in order to deconstruct the established authorities in various fields. And Latour said, my God, how did I realize that people would have done this in the first place? I would have never said these things. Well, come on, hello, are you a sociologist? Don't you realize what happens when your stuff gets out there? I mean, you either mean it or you don't mean it. You see? And so in that sense, I think that's disingenuous. Okay? Whereas I, as you know, since I've been involved with this intelligent design controversy, I don't actually have any problem with this. Social constructivism can enter into the public sphere and should be, you know, I mean, and in a sense, the fact that facts are socially constructed is something that, in a way, if it is something that we really do believe in science and technology studies, then it is something that it's not just good for the seminar room, it's not just good for those peer-reviewed publications that get us RAE points, but it is also good to discuss in the public sphere. Now, whether we've mastered the art of doing that is another matter. Right, and I'm not going to say I'm any kind of master of this, right, because all kinds of problems with what I do. But the point is that insofar as one believes, you know, that this stuff isn't, you know, is in some sense true, then there is a kind of obligation rather than just saying, oh my God, when the consequences are bad, we just recoil. Because, in this respect, Sokal won, right? I mean, I think it's unequivocal, right? If there's any doubt in this room, Sokal won the science wars over the rest of us. By the way in which the field has kind of moved. Okay? And indeed, Latour goes so far as to talk about that we're now post-critical. Okay? Now, that was the sort of term Michael Polanyi used in the 1950s to discuss, right, personal knowledge, science is personal knowledge. Post-critical. Okay? And I don't think that's a good sign from an ideological standpoint. So, I mean, it seems to me that we've got a kind of real issue here, that the fact-fiction distinction is one that, in a way, we still need to face quite squarely. Now, there's another angle on this, which I also want to put on. So I'm putting this part on the table because I think this is quite a contemporary way in which this is reflected. You know, as someone who, in a sense, was very bemused by the kind of responses that the Sokal hoax raised within our own community, it was really interesting how the literary critics and the cultural studies people who were kind of on the sidelines watching this, one of the first things they started to do was to say, well, either you get immersed into the science or you just say you're merely talking about language.
Right, and the literary critics are quite comfortable with the latter, right? And we can leave the former to the Harry Collinses of the world. Okay?
And I think that's really unfortunate, because part of the force of science and technology studies has been the idea of the reconstruction of science by realizing that whatever facts we talk about in science are themselves products of construction, and then that one needs to understand the social institutions and organizations by which those constructions occur, and perhaps change those so, as it were, one comes up with different constructions of the facts. It seems to me that part of the story has been completely dropped. Okay? And that was the part of the story that was associated with things like democratization of science and all that other stuff, which in a way is kind of dropped out of the agenda as well, at least within science and technology studies. Okay? So that's one part of the story. That's a story I think that's, in a way, most visible. Now, there's another part of the story, and this has to do with something that I only found out about through my interest in the origins of sociology as a discipline in this country, in Britain. First chair in sociology in this country was in 1907 at the London School of Economics. And it was a chair that was awarded to Leonard Hobhouse. Is that a name to people realize and remember? Hobhouse, right? Who is a kind of a liberal political theorist, kind of social liberal, okay? A person who was from the sort of neo-Hegelian tradition of Oxford and was for a while writing for the Manchester Guardian a person who believed in evolution, but believed in a very sort of purposive notion of evolution with human beings at the sort of the leading end of it. And through him, we start to get this Department of Social Theory and Institutions at the London School of Economics, right, which moves into the 20th century. Now, the interesting thing is to look at who the alternative candidates are. Okay, and this is where things start to get... And if you're interested in following that story, I recommend Ralph Dahrendorf's History of the LSE. Okay, he wrote a 100-year history of the LSE, came out in 1995, and this is where this story, in a way, is recounted, is where I first encountered. And so the question is, what is sociology, right? How do you establish sociology as a discipline in this country? Because you've got to keep in mind that sociology, up to that point in the late 19th century, was primarily understood as Auguste Comte's project, which is a kind of, you know, weird, quasi-political, religious kind of thing that had a fairly kind of ambiguous placement within the academy. It wasn't a discipline, right? It was more like the name of a political movement, a religious movement, or something of that kind. And any of you who know something about the history of sociology in Germany will know that there's a lot of ambivalence about using that word to talk about what the people like Weber and Zimmel and all these guys are doing, right? I mean, because that had all kinds of political connotations that seemed kind of suspect, okay? However, this chair in sociology in the London School of Economics is being funded by the Fabians, Sidney and Beatrice Webb, who have all kind of progressive designs on the future of humanity kind of thing. And so they're not, in a way, they're not so alien from what people like Comte were up to, Auguste Comte was up to with positivism and sociology. So who are the candidates? It's not just Hobhouse. We've got Francis Galton, Mr. Eugenics, okay? And he's a viable candidate. Another candidate is Patrick Geddes, who some of you may know. He's kind of come back into fashion because he's seen as kind of one of the forefathers of environmental sociology. Okay, and he's a guy who was a student of Thomas Henry Huxley. Okay, who then moved into kind of this kind of understanding of the social realm, but primarily in an area that we would now consider, urban and regional planning kind of side of things, right? So he was very much concerned with how people are distributed across various kinds of areas, how they interact with each other, but understood very much from a naturalistic standpoint, I would say, okay? And there's been a kind of modest revival of his fortunes recently, but he didn't get the chair either, okay? Now, the other candidate, and this is the candidate I want to say a little bit about here, it was H.G. Wells.
H.G. Wells, okay?
Now, H.G. Wells, you see, is interesting because there we talk about somebody straddling the fact-fiction distinction, okay? And there is and the interesting thing, if you read, I don't know how many of you know this book, the book came out about 20 years ago by Wolf Lepenies, a German sociologist, called Between Literature and Science.
It's published in Cambridge University Press series that Quentin Skinner edited. And it's very interesting because there is this chapter on Wells as somebody who straddles this distinction here. And Wells gave an interesting lecture, as it were, in support of his candidacy, because all these people had to do like little auditions, right? And Dahrendorf talks about it as well. And Wells basically puts himself in what he sees as the tradition of sociology, in which he is the logical successor. Okay? And it is basically a lineage of utopia. Right? So he is starting talking about the Enlightenment people, right? And this whole idea that when people start to get a grip on how the past has developed, then they kind of realize what's right and what's wrong, and then what sociology does is, as it were, you know, projects the good stuff. And so it comes up with these kinds of alternative sort of societies, and then people can kind of try them out. And as it were, the relevant level of experimentation is at the level of living through it. Right? So you live through these things. And so Wells, as part of this, is not particularly... He's not afraid of Galton, okay? So he's willing to take on the eugenic stuff, but it's not just limited to that, right? So in where, you know, we construct new worlds, basically, okay? And I think by, you know, in terms of today's jargon, he would be considered having a performative understanding of sociology. Right? Right? Performative, right? You make it, you do it, you construct it, you be it. Okay? And he actually talks about people like Spencer and Comte as being in this lineage as well, and to opposite effect, okay? Because so, as it were, one could perform sociology to radically different effects, and Marx and Engels as well. Right, so the idea here is, right, Spencer, obviously with a kind of laissez-faire view, right, wants to basically dismantle all of these kinds of hereditary privileges and things that were, in fact, preventing individuals from being able to spontaneously organize themselves and so forth. And then you have Marx and Engels, of course, with their agenda, and Comte with this kind of very global, unifying kind of, you know, all of humanity moving together in one space kind of thing. And Wells's view was, well, in a sense, this covers the conceptual space of sociology. And that, you know, insofar as we collect empirical data, which he had nothing against as well, right? He was all for that, and he was for it to be made publicly available. It would be in support of these various visions, right? And so you'd have the sociologists would put the visions out there, and then you would collect the data, and you'd see, well, how can you make these things happen? And if they happen and if they survive, then that's kind of the proof of the pudding and the eating. Okay, that was his vision of sociology. Okay, and it was regarded as unworkable. Okay, but that was a vision of sociology, and it was one that was taken quite seriously. And the interesting thing, of course, is once Wells failed to get this chair, right? You know the rest of his career, okay? Where we've got the science fiction, we've got you know, and we've got all kinds of, you know, the man is an endless prognosticator, right? I mean, if you have to use a word to describe him, he's talking about the future of everything. I mean, you can now go, if you go to the British Library, you can get these BBC radio things of his from the 1930s. I've got them. It's amazing. He's just like pontificate. He can tell you the future of anything. You know, and it's not merely, and it's sophisticated in the sense it's not merely extrapolations from what's currently happening, but he says these are just temporary things, there are these underlying long-term trends we should pay attention to. And this was kind of what his vision of sociology originally was. Okay. Now, you know, when you think about what do you call that kind of thing? Because, see, we use this category science fiction,
Right. But Wells was not the sort of guy who actually,
you know, sort of cut up his corpus into these different sorts of genres that way. And this is a man, you know, who's living well into the 20th century, right? And basically thinks he is in a cognitive intellectual enterprise, right, that obviously has a factual basis, but does not exclude fiction as part of its cognitive base. Okay. And that's kind of interesting. And in a way, of course, no one... You know, if you assign someone like H.G. Wells, I mean, it's interesting because when I was a student in sociology in the 1970s, right, there was this kind of vogue for sociology through literature. Okay, but it never talked about H.G. Wells. It was like more like Tolstoy and Dostoevsky, and you know, and that kind of thing about the typically at the interpersonal level, right, at the sort of micro kind of stuff. It wasn't the kind of stuff that Wells was concerned about, which were more civilizational things. But nevertheless, it seems to me that this is an example of someone who in a way, didn't see any kind of sharp break between the factual and the fictional, and saw it was in service of a discipline that didn't need to necessarily respect those kinds of boundaries, okay, and continued acting along those ways subsequently. And you know, one of the things one can look at is the market for this. For whom was, you know, who was persuaded by this stuff? Obviously the guy was selling some books, right, but who was buying them, who was reading them, who was promoting this kind of stuff, right? Because it was quite clear this was quite explicitly excluded from the academic community. Okay. How much more time do I have?
10 minutes,
okay. Now, one of the things that I've thought about in all this has been exactly how does one want to distinguish fact and fiction when we make these kinds of discussions? Because I think we all know, especially in this day and age, it's become very common. It's always been common in the writing of novels. And perhaps you know this, that that if you look at the origin of the novel as a genre, which is probably the genre of literature that most looks like academic writing in a way, that very often these people who engage in it were in fact academically trained and for various reasons did not go into academia and sort of broader kind of market. And it's very common nowadays, you know, given that authors are always being interviewed and everything, for authors to talk a lot about the amount of research that they do, right, novelistic authors, about the amount of research that they do in order to, you know, give their characters and their plots the appropriate kind of life to them. Okay, so the issue of there being research and that one in some sense is constrained by facts seems to be quite common. It's always been sort of common between novelistic forms, certainly, and the academic stuff. I mean, Lepenis makes a big deal about this. And then the issue becomes, okay, where's the difference? And I think one way one might think about the difference is the fact that it has to do with the stuff that you're not, that as it were, is the status of the stuff that is unsaid or unevidenced. Right, the stuff that you don't actually have some kind of evidence for. What is the status of that? And you can have, you might say, a realist or an anti-realist attitude toward that, to the stuff that is not evidenced or not said. So if you have a realist attitude, there's a sense in which, you know, if there's some detail, as it were, of the story of how the plot of a certain kind of situation goes that you don't happen to know, there's some fact out there, there's some sort of evidence that would resolve the issue for you. But if you're an anti-realist about this, then it's up to your imagination to fill it in. Okay? And then you take a more direct responsibility for the resulting plot. Do people buy it or not? Right? And so in that sense, the onus falls on you. So if people don't like your story, don't think it's persuasive, you bear the burden. Okay? Whereas in the case of the there being a realist approach to what's unsaid and unevidenced, in a sense, you say, well, look, the facts say this, right? This stuff that I found say this. And if I don't have such a thing to give you, I don't say anything. I keep it open. I say, other people do it. I don't feel like I have to fill it in myself. Okay? And I actually think that when we get right down to it, that's really the difference. It's a difference between a realist and an anti-realist attitude toward the gaps. Okay, I mean, because one of the things that I've come to this conclusion largely by reading about how novelists, not only nowadays, though nowadays they seem to talk a lot about what they do, but also in the 19th and early 20th century about how they go about, you know, coming up with their plots and their character sketches and, you know, how do they do this kind of thing? And it's not very different from how us as professional academics do our business. They spend time in libraries, they read books, they think about things. I mean, I think this is especially true for those of us who are in the humanities and social sciences, that the modus operandi is not that different. There's just a kind of philosophical point, you might say, about what is the significance of the stuff that is still left open. Okay? Is it realist or anti-realist? If it's an anti-realist, you fill in the gaps. You, as it were, start to perform the narrative. You take the responsibility for it. Right? It becomes your story. Okay? Whereas otherwise, right, there's something out there you haven't yet found. And you're looking for it. Okay? Now, this has interesting consequences, I think, with regard to how we want to think about science. Okay? Because science, at least as I understand it, is an ongoing collective project of humanity. Right? It isn't ended yet. Okay? It's a kind of open field, right? And people drawing on many different strands and so forth. Okay? And it seems to me what this allows us to do is, you might say, give a greater space. And, you know, I think about this in the context of, you know, public presentations of science for enactments, performances. Okay, where you actually do fill in the gaps with your imaginative things and say this kind of mode of operating, where you're going well beyond what any evidence can provide, but you're somehow making it alive, is contributing to science as a vibrant, ongoing enterprise, rather than, as it were, something that you should know about because there are some facts out there and they've already established, and if we don't know what they are, we're going to find them soon, but they're somehow behind us. They're not part of what we are. They're not part of who we are. Right? Because, I mean, I think the important thing, and this is where the science communication point, is literally we have got to be the ones communicating science. So the science has to, in some sense, be embodied in this, and we have to have the right attitude toward the subject matter in order to embody it appropriately. And I think the appropriate attitude is to say it's an open thing. It's an open thing, not only with regard to where it can go in the future, but also how it has been in the past. And so all of the filling in of the stuff that we don't know, that some people might call historical novels and stuff of that kind, is quite integral, it seems to me, to keeping science alive as an enterprise. And in a sense, that's kind of the, you know, so we're beginning to see things like this guy, The Tragedy of Thomas Hobbes. Do you recall this play? It was this, how many? I'm not getting any. Nobody knows this. Okay. Okay. There was a play that was performed in the Royal Shakespeare Company last autumn called The Tragedy of Thomas Hobbes. Did you know that? You didn't know that, did you? Okay. I'm sorry. I didn't realize this was going to be. I thought people here would know this. Okay, the guy, his name is Chaplin, I think. God, I thought people would already know this. Adrian Chaplin or something like this. And the point is, if you've read Leviathan and the Air Pump, Chapin and Schaffer, okay, in a way, it's almost like a dramatization of that. Okay? And it really works on this idea that because there's the plague in London, you can't actually have public dramatic performances, so the experiments become the public dramatic performances. And so the scientists of the day, right, the Boyles and Hooks and people of that kind, Wallace, right, and then Newton and Hobbes, right, all these people are, you know, in a way kind of scientist actors. And they're persuading each other. They're trying to make, you know, and they're trying to vie to kind of impress King Charles, you know, that in fact what they're doing in these experiments, which look very kind of recherché and strange and so forth, are in fact representations of generalizations of laws of nature. And they're trying to act it all out, right? And remember, this is a culture that has yet to be fully won over to the idea that an experiment happening in a local place can actually have this kind of larger implication. So you see all this kind of theatrics going on. And then, in fact, the play, I mean, I've read the play. I didn't get a chance to see it. It was only in performance for about a month. and maybe that's why you didn't see it either.
But the point was that this is like a lot of motion and action and hand-waving and, you know, kind of pantomime reality going on, right? And it seems to me this is very much what I'm talking about here, in a way in which how you make the signs vivid in a way that people believe there's actually something there that's worth taking forward. Not only in terms of what the play was talking about, but also in the medium of the play as a vehicle by which to get this across.
And there was a Simon Schaffer had an interview with this guy Chaplin at the Royal Society, I believe, last November on this. I'm surprised people aren't aware of this. You guys are science communicators. I mean, it seems to me this is a very interesting kind of way of moving, okay? Where, in a sense, the openness of the science is presented in a way that invites kind of participation and contribution and so forth. And in a way that I think is quite consistent with the social constructivist scruples that is very much part of what I take to have been very much the cutting edge of science studies over the last 20, 30 years, but which to a certain extent has kind of been lost because of things like the Sokol hoax, of things like people being afraid about what creationists and, you know, and global warming deniers will do with science studies and all the rest of it. But nevertheless, I think that is kind of the way in which science communication should go in terms of properly representing science as something that is true to sort of the constructivist nature of the enterprise. And I'll stop there.
Thanks very much, Steve. Steve wanted to leave a good 20 minutes for discussion because clearly he's raised a whole bunch of very interesting issues that I'm sure we're going to want to jump in on. So who would like to ask the first question, please?
There is a history of people using fiction and dramatisation for very realist purposes. People like George Gallo's Mr. Tompkins stories, which are explicitly very fantastical.
Yeah.
And yet he has a very realist point, and there's no sense that behind it there is a social constructivist.
Yeah.
But it's very easy to say, put a bit of drama into this and we can start.
No.
It's allow debate, but actually it can be used to cut down debate and to make things seem vivid.
I'm glad that was the point you were trying to make with this. Yes. Yes, exactly, of course.
And I think, you know, when one talks about rhetorical manipulation, this is what you're referring to, I think, with regard to that.
But of course, but in a sense, this is where one needs to be sensitive with how this is being deployed. I don't see this as an argument against fiction per se. It's just obviously the rhetorical contextualizing of this fiction is very important to keep in mind, it seems to me. But I agree with you. Yes, of course.
I'm a writer in residence at Edinburgh University. I write fiction, and I used to be a scientist. And I'm actually going to be talking about this afternoon, about how these processes of doing science and doing fiction are very similar from a sort of practitioner point of view. And I was particularly interested in what you were saying about whether gaps occur, particularly in fiction. And I think there's a tension about how fiction writers can tolerate the gaps. I think there are gaps. There are essential gaps that the reader always has to fill in, and I think the fiction writer can always be sort of content for that process to happen in a way that perhaps science writers can't. But at the same time, I think there is a tension, because as a fiction writer, you still need to be in control of your material. And if the reader gets a sense that the fiction writer does not understand the universe that they have created, then that can lead to a lack of confidence, if you like, and a sort of breakdown in the sort of fictional world that is trying to be communicated, a breakdown in communication.
Yes, I agree with you, and I think the point that you're raising there is the kind of point that scientists need to realize about fiction writing, because I think there's a tendency when one talks about the fact-fiction divide to imagine fiction is just, you know, anything goes. Right? And that comes from a complete lack of understanding of how fiction is crafted and the history of fiction and all the rest of it. And in a sense, scientists need to understand exactly the point you're saying, that there are very significant constraints, right? And the best fiction works under very tight constraints, actually, right? But the openness is at the, you know, crucial junctures.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, no, that's
Exactly.
And that, I think, is a very important point that needs to be brought across to scientists so they can appreciate the similarity between the two. Yeah.
As a kind of You could possibly play devil's advocate here on behalf of the working scientists, because the example you use is historical, right? So Hobbes and Boyle are dead, and generally historians are talking about...
So you say! DNA, who knows, right? I mean...
it's easier to tell these kinds of stories when you're talking about people who aren't there. Is there not a danger that if you take this kind of example and run with it and say that we need to do this more with contemporary science, that you're going to rub up a lot of people the wrong way, a lot of scientists who are still around?
Well, look, I mean, the point of doing this is, again, I do think that the performative as opposed to the representational aspect of this needs to be stressed, right? So in other words, the issue is not trying to reproduce or imitate a scientist here, right? But rather to convey a kind of sense of the spirit of the project so others can participate in. So, for example, having a play that dramatizes, let's say, the evolution-creationism debate in a kind of very interesting way rather than the kind of stereotyped ways in which it tends to be. Because, I was involved in this trial in Pennsylvania, 4 years ago now, and one of the ways in which the trial was straitjacketed was because of the particular interpretation of the U.S. Constitution about separation of church and state and how science and religion play out in light of that. But supposing you remove that constraint from the situation, and then you have a different context in which you actually have this discussion and that's being enacted. You see, then you can get some different consequences. And it seems to me this goes back to the point about the types of constraints that you can manipulate, as a dramatist or as a fiction author and so forth, not to get rid of all constraints, but to kind of change one constraint or two constraints and then get a sense of how the things would go. That's kind of what I'm talking about here. It's not about trying to reproduce what, actual people said at actual times. That's not really, I think, the main point here.
Yeah, thank you very much. I have a question on the STS and the surface focus in the story.
Yes.
If you look at constructive technology assessment, then it uses future scenarios as a way of, informed scenarios, they're fictitious, but they're also fictional.
Right.
And, they're accepted to the public, to participants, to scenario workshops.
That's right.
So that seems to be...
Yeah, that's in the spirit.
That seems to work there.
Yes, that's right. That's in the spirit, right? But that kind of... and I have nothing against that, and I like that and everything, but you might say the rhetoric of it is technical. In a sense that it's presented in a fairly narrow way. You don't present this, let's say, in a theater.
No, but you can present it in a political theater.
Sure. No, again, yes, but still, it's... See, I'm talking about something that could actually be much more public than that. But you're right. This kind of scenario business is very much in the spirit of that. It's just that this tends to be seen as something that one does in a fairly restricted context, it seems to me. That I think, is the difference. Because, remember, my point about the social constructivism and stuff is that we should go more public, right? And the problem with the Sokol hoax was when... social constructivism gets exposed with this parody, the social constructivists retreat. Right? And my point is, no, you just go public. You see? So you see the point.
Yeah, a few things. Actually, first of all, we've talked about science, and we've talked about fiction, we've talked about H.G. Wells. We haven't said science fiction, so I'm going to say it.
Okay.
And I think that there's... since Hugo Gernsback, started, with the pulp magazines, that there was a tradition then of scientists writing for these pulp magazines. It was really, there was an intention to communicate science to the public through cheap magazines and fantastic stories. And I don't think that's gone away, but I think that actually science fiction itself and the literary criticism of science fiction, which... for a while was doing a really valuable job of worrying away at those gaps, has somehow disappeared and somehow, also suffered from the science wars in some way. But there's still some stuff coming out. Chimey Aville, I don't know whether anybody knows. It is quite new stuff. It's been labelled new weird. There was cyberpunk and now there's new weird and whatever. Cyberpunk itself had a valuable job to do.
Mm-hmm.
And Frederick James, some people like Frederick James,
sure,
and Baudrillard were
yep,
very interested in cyberpunk.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that there was a really good interaction between cyberpunk and between some of these cultural theorists. I think it was some really interesting things were coming out of that. And that kind of died a death, and but this new weird may be quite promising, but it needs people to jump in there, it needs people not to be afraid to be literary critics.
Yeah.
And to amplify what some of this fiction is saying.
Well, yes, and I think one of the... I recently participated in Sci-Fi London in May, okay? And I think one problem that this whole science fiction business has in this respect is it's become very insular. As it were, there's enough people already interested in it for its own sake, you might say, kind of into its own aesthetic, that in a way, it's kind of the victims of success problem, right? That there is enough of a critical mass that can keep the thing insular, right? There isn't, you know, and I think that's the problem. I mean, it really does require people... people like myself, others who are kind of in the outside of this, to make a noise about it, to really push it outside, right? Because the sci-fi guys just love talking to themselves and, you know, having their pub quizzes forever and, you know, all the rest of it.
I don't do sci-fi conferences anymore for that reason.
Yeah.
Bob. I suppose two related, slightly sort of theoretical problems. One is that the category of performance that you're talking about, I think could even do more work than you're suggesting. Performances between fact and fiction, or neither fact nor fiction, or both.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If it doesn't, those distinctions don't neatly map on the performance.
Right.
Which is what makes performance interesting in a different way than, say, film. And the other point is I think we need a bit more clarity about social constructivism, because there's an awful lot of them about, and I think what some of the pro-SoCal people really have as their target is those varieties of social constructivism, which in the end deny any distinction between fiction. Rather, no social constructivists who say that there are a number of ways of drawing that distinction, which is of course necessary to just any language.
Well, see, I'm not sure. Okay, I mean, I don't get into any sort of heavy, really heavy discussion here, but I'm not actually sure that the fact-fiction distinction as such needs to be drawn. Okay, I think that there is this interesting, you might say, literary conventional distinction that we were just talking about the difference between, you know, writing a history and writing a novel in terms of the kinds of constraints that one is under, and there's a certain point, you know, as it were, if you take away one constraint or add another constraint, you're in one genre versus another genre, okay, and you might call that one fact and that one fiction, but that's a conventional distinction, it seems to me, okay? What I don't want to accede to, and this is where I am really a social constructivist, is some kind of absolute notion of fact and fiction as a distinction, somewhere, somehow. I don't actually believe there is such a distinction. I think it's a very conventional thing. Okay, and that in fact you can have a culture where the distinction's not made at all. Oh yes, and in fact, well, here's where you want a test case for this. And I was going to actually begin the talk with this example, but I decided not to because I didn't. Since you already raised the fact that I'm a creationist or something, I didn't want to bring that more in there. But you are familiar with Archbishop Usher. Right, who is the one, the young Earth creationist mascot, right? And so in the early 17th century, he calculates the ages of the patriarchs in the Bible and says, you know, what is it, the night before the 23rd of October, 4004 BC, creation happened, okay? And the interesting thing about this, right, is that this was a novelty when he proposed it because people weren't reading the Bible or any kind of authoritative text as it were, having that kind of hardness to it in terms of what was being claimed, right? In fact, the sort of standing, you might say, theory of interpretation that the church had up to this point was this kind of Thomas Aquinas business, which was a bit loosey-goosey, right? It was all about analogical reasoning in different domains and stuff like that, and that there was a lot of interpretive flexibility around. And indeed, one of the reasons why Galileo had gotten in trouble around the same period Usher is writing is because Galileo's trying to maintain some hard stuff. He's trying to say, look, the Bible's wrong. Okay? And just, you know, so making that distinction, right, that was the problem. Because people before that point, at least from the standpoint of authoritative forms of knowledge, were living normally with a lot of interpretive flexibility, and basically what mattered was who was speaking. Right? So what office did you hold?
right? Were you the bishop? Were you the priest? Were you the whatever? Right? It wasn't the nature of the language. It was who was saying it. But otherwise, there's an enormous amount of interpretive flexibility. It's when Galileo comes in and says, no, this claim contradicts this claim, and I don't care whether you're a priest or a scientist or whatever, this is right and this is wrong. That's when you start to get this modern fact-fiction distinction going.
Okay, we completely differ about what fact-fiction
means. Okay, no, no, but you see what I'm saying here?
Oh, yeah, except that interpretation is one thing. Of course, you're right about Galileo and Usher, but fact-fiction, in my view at least, refers to
okay, no, no, but the point is it has implications for how the Bible then gets interpreted, right? Because when people want to deny Usher, they start to say, well, maybe the Bible's not factual. Right?
Okay. I'm interested in a rather different direction mm-hmm. coming out of social constructivism, and one that I think is harder to address and more complex than the one that you've described. And that's what I would describe as the ontological term and developments of new forms of materialism, and sometimes using the label realism as well. And yeah. I'm interested in these because they seem to be much more complicated and complex in terms of their politics, their generative motivation, I think. Partly in response to certain concerns about ecology, partly in some concern about a kind of intellectual mm-hmm. and political modesty.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, know where you're coming from.
And I'd be curious to know what you think about.
What to say? It's hard to say anything in short compass about this. As you point out, I think, the politics of this is profoundly ambiguous. Okay? I guess... See, I'm one of these people, I hate to sound like Obama here, but I'm one of these people who believes in change, okay? And in other words, I like an ontology with change, and I'm always a little suspicious if we've got ontology of objects as a result. I much prefer ontology of constructions, because that suggests deconstruction. That suggests a kind of world where the seams are, at least in principle, evident, and you can, you know, change them and open them and all the rest of it. And the problem with the object stuff is that sometimes I think... It looks to me like one is just reifying lots of different domains and not making any kind of principled decisions about the relative significance or how they relate to each other or anything. And I think this business about humility that you were suggesting falls into that category, frankly. I mean, see, I think this ontological turn is, in a way, an overreaction to what was seen, rightly or wrongly, and I think increasingly wrongly, as this sort of reductionist... kind of imperialist, heavy-handed kind of way of looking at the world where certain sorts of things and voices were being privileged over others. And so then you get this kind of pendulum swing, which basically flattens the ontology. So you got objects, they're all on the same plane. They all, as it were, in principle, have equal access to each other. There's no privileged position. And we're humble. We just kind of observe this stuff and follow them around. Okay? I think that's not the answer at all, frankly. And I think part of what goes on there is a certain abdication of the political and moral responsibility of the inquirer. Because however much one wants to criticize reductionists and imperialists and hierarchicalists and so forth, you knew exactly where they were coming from. Right? It was very clear what the voice was. And so therefore you could criticize it and you could oppose it. But nowadays, if you make everything diffuse, it's not clear, you know, where the action is. Where exactly how would one criticize a position like this? And that's why people like Latour, for example, who endorses a view like the one you're talking about, talks about his position as post-critical. Okay? And I think that's pretty dangerous, especially when we're talking about science as the framework within which this ontological picture is being presented.
A quick question before we
start. Sure, sure.
I suppose it's a rather abstract question. You summed up the difference, the core difference that you're talking about as a difference in terms of anti-realism or realism with mm-hmm. respect to the gaps.
Yeah.
And it occurs to me, could we not also map onto that a difference between something like, potentiality or the possible
yeah.
and actuality.
Yes.
So is not the question more, you're presented with an actuality. There's two orientations to that. Yes, that is fact, and give me more facts. Let's learn more about facts. Or, on the other hand, the potentiality response to that, which is, what can we do with these facts? What future can we make with these inherited facts? Which seems to be a slightly different spin than just realism, anti-realism.
You're right. You're right about that. And I think the value that the potentiality approach has is that, in a sense, if you, as the person who, as it were, is presented with these gaps, identifies with the potentiality, you, in some sense, are part of what, you know, will realize these potentials one way or another. So I do think it has that kind of advantage. Because you're right, the realism, anti-realism language tends to be very much the language of representation. Yeah, you're right about that. So, the potentiality thing might actually be better from that standpoint, where, namely, you have these actualities here, but there are these hidden potentials, and how you realize them, as it were, is your. Yeah, yeah, that would certainly, account for things. So I would agree with that.
Thank you. Well, on that pleasant note, I thought thank Steve very much for a fascinating presentation. Thank you.
Thank you.
I suppose